Great morning, precious people. You know what time it is. That's right. It's time for your talk show. That's right, your talk show, The Culture Call. With your boy, L. Spencer Smith, right here on Praise 93.3, 790 WTSK. It is the place where Tuscaloosa indeed meets the world. And, of course, for the next 2 hours, from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., we're going to be talking a little bit about everything, from society to sports, education to economics, and definitely from religion to relationships. As always, we are here to create a safe space. That's right, a safe space to have empowering, provocative, and yes, even sometimes, you know it, controversial conversations. And guess what, y'all? You can call in and chat it up with me. Yeah, as we learn together right here on The Culture Call. Hey, shout out number one goes to all of our first-time listeners. If this is your first time coming across the Culture Call, I want to say welcome. Welcome to the CC family. We are so elated to have you with us on this morning. Listen, we are peacock proud that you are tuning in and lending us your ear to have conversation about what affects our community. Huh? Yeah. Not just locally, but all around the world. Yeah, because we are one human family. So welcome. So whether you are at your cubicle or riding through the city, or maybe you're on spring break vacation, you stumbled across this. Hey, welcome to The Culture Call. Shout out number two. As always, I want to say thank you to our faithful and consistent committed listeners who cause us to be at the top all the time. Listen, I'm telling you, without you, there would be no Culture Call. There would be no ratings. There would be no anything. Hey, but I am glad and grateful that every morning you tune in to hear what this little boy gonna say today, what this crazy man is going to bring up today. And I'm grateful that you're listening and that you embrace me and hug me in the street when you see me. Hey, I was at dinner on Sunday. I forgot to mention this. I was at dinner on Sunday. A lady stopped me while I was going in the restaurant. You Bishop Smith, you on that Culture Call now? Yes, and I hugged her and everything. Hey, I'm so glad you all are listening. It makes me feel really good. So keep tuning in right here on the Culture Call. And then last but not least, shout out number three. We want to give it up for Brother Jay. Absolutely. We thank God for him. We are praying for him always. His strength, his mind, his wisdom, everything that he brings to Praise 93.3 and 790 WTSK and that he has done for years. We are so glad and elated to have him in our lives. And so, hey, we send a big shout out to him as always. Listen, I want to encourage you to go to your app store on your Apple or your Android device. Yeah. And go ahead and you will search out Praise 93.3. Download that if you will. Then you're going to find that. God needs you to go ahead and download it. Put it on your phone. Yeah, go ahead, tap it. I know that's what you're doing. Go ahead, tap it. Yeah, and that means that you can make this station and this music and this news and this everything portable. You can take it with you wherever you go, no matter what you're doing, right? Just put your ear pods in or your earphones in and cruise out with us throughout the day. Doesn't matter where you are. Doesn't matter what you're doing. We want to make sure that you hear us all around the world, huh? We want to make sure definitely you hear us in Tuscaloosa, in Birmingham, and Mobile, Montgomery, Huntsville, Gordo, Reform, Utah, Aliceville, Bologie, no matter where you are, name your city. If you got the app, you can hear us. All of the wonderful things, all of the wonderful programming, all of the important news reports, the weather, let me say that again, the weather. Yeah, because, you know, as we are in these transitional months, March and April, it gets really interesting around Alabama. So we want to definitely have something that, hey, if you can't be at a radio or whatever, at a regular radio, you'll have that app and it'll tell you all of the important information. So I need to make sure that you get that app. Hey, please do that for me. All right. Also, I definitely need you to send in your public service announcements and events to culturecall.praise@gmail.com. That's culturecall.praise@gmail.com. And give us an opportunity, to let Lottie, Dottie, and everybody know what are the wonderful things that are going on at your church or your organization, your sorority, your fraternity. Maybe you're an artist getting ready to have a concert or a preacher getting ready to preach a revival. Doesn't matter what it is. I want you to send it in. Again, that's culturecall.praise@gmail.com. And here it is. I need you also to write down this number, 205-752-4800, 205-752-4800, and call in. Hey, but here it is. If you can't call in, because I know a lot of you, to 10 to 12, you're at your work hours. I get it. I totally understand. And I see some of y'all like, Bishop, I really want to call in. L, I really want to call in, but I'm at work. I totally, hey, calm down. Calm down. I get it. Yeah, but that Apple calls you to, there's a chat feature that while we're on the air, you can send me your comment. You can send me your amen. You can send me, nah, dog, that ain't it. You can do it all on that app. So please go ahead and just stay in touch. Hey, we want to hear from you. Also, follow us on social media on Facebook. Yeah, Facebook Meta is what they call it now. Huh? The Culture Call. That's right. All you got to do, if you haven't done it already, is go to The Culture Call. The Culture Call. Add that article there. The. And press the like button, that thumbs up button. And now you are a part of the CC family online. Yeah. Well, it didn't take a lot, right? Absolutely. So I want you to do that so we can stay connected throughout the week and you can find out all of the wonderful things that we have going on here and that we're going to be talking about throughout the month, right? Hey, do me a favor, sit back and relax, grab you some coffee. You know how we do it, Maxwell House, the Starbucks. Maybe coffee is not your thing. Hey, get you some herbal tea. Get you some herbal tea, some chamomile if you're trying to calm down, green tea if you're trying to get a little caffeine kick for toward lunch, and hibiscus. Y'all remember that? Yeah, that tart rare tea. Yeah, that's going to help you with your diabetes, your blood, your cholesterol, all of it. Yeah, get that hibiscus tea. And if you don't like tea or coffee, you can always get that water. That's right, spring or alkaline water. Flush out that system. Yeah, wake those cells up. And come on, y'all, let's get into the culture. Listen, this is International Women's Month, so we're going to be talking a little bit about that on this morning. Just some powerful women who have done amazing things, past, present, and who are already directing toward the future of what's getting ready to happen. I'm telling you, we've got some powerful women, powerful, powerful women here in Alabama and definitely in our community. And also, I want to share this month talking about innovative education strategies. We're coming closer to the end of the year. We've got a couple of more months, and I want to talk about innovative education strategies because I think it is important for us to think about how we are educating our children in the times where there is talk and chatter of dismantling the Department of Education. There's a lot of going on in state boards of education, county and city boards, all of those different kinds of some movement and transition. But at the end of the day, I want us to talk about and really educate ourselves on some of the innovative educational strategies that are coming up or that are happening all around the country and, dare I say, even all around the world and other countries. And that will probably be great, really good for our children, right? That I think that that is the most important thing. Sometimes we can get caught up in the harangue. We can get caught up in the menagerie of the political aspect of, you know, how we're going to fund it, how we're going to pay for it, how we're going to do this, and what should they learn? STEM, math, how are they going to pass the test? And, you know, as a former teacher, I've been a part of those boards and I've been a part of those conversations to have these issues addressed. And at the bottom line, at the end of the day, that the most important asset in this whole educational process are the children, are those who are coming to our school systems and through our school systems, whether that be public and or private, because just because it's private does not mean that it is better than public. It just means probably in one instance it has more funding but less students, which causes teacher effectiveness and efficiency to rise more probably than in the public school sector. But nonetheless, wherever you teach, the important thing is the students. Are they learning? Can they learn? And we're going to talk about that, can they learn, in just a moment. Because there are cultural and, epistemological things that we got to discuss, things that how they start out, head start. We got to talk about those things, where they're getting their basic pedagogy, both teacher and student, right? Because if the teacher is not well learned, then it's sad to say that the student probably will not be if they are in the classroom. They may have passed the test or the certification or the praxis, but can they culturally identify or do they understand cultural relevance as they begin to teach and to begin imparting information into our children? I think that's very important, right? With the proliferation all around the country of removing certain books and certain ideas that reflect an inclusive nation, an inclusive society, we also have to talk about the ethics of education, the ethics of education. Every educational practice, every educator, every school system, every school, if I can say that, every curriculum, if I can, has a particular ethos, has a particular ethic, right? And you can tell how that school system or how that that board or whatever, who you know, that director of curriculum or that community views that child by looking at what they are willing for that child to learn, right? And that's very important, right? And if we don't really pull the layers back on the education as it is, and as it was, as it is, and as it will become, then not only will our community be late, last, and lost, but the entire country will be, because perhaps we are using antiquated frameworks to educate our children when there are more efficient ways and effective ways to get our children to be educated so that they can be the leaders of tomorrow, right? I think that's very important. We have to begin to weigh our standards. And I know in education, we have to also talk about, you know, because education requires teachers, it requires an infrastructure, teachers and administrators who, watch this, need to be fully informed about the cultural relevance of their curriculum, of their school, of their teachers, right? That if you have an education system that is stuck in the 60s and the 70s, and let's even go back to in the 2000s, if you got a school system and a superintendent who are just, you know, a bit on doing the same kind of practices, protocols, and principles of 25 years ago. Yes, can you believe it? 2000 was 25 years ago. Then you have to understand they are really educating a child that is really no longer been born from the 2000 age. There was a whole cultural thing that was going on. There was a whole realization of global phenomenon that was going on, that the history books, have they updated themselves to reflect between 2000 to 2025? Are we dealing with outdated information? History is one thing, but when your textbooks at large do not reflect the current phenomena that has happened in the world for 25 years. Now, understand I'm being kind just to say 2000. Right. Because if what our children are learning has not been updated for 25 years, then we have a problem and we're not preparing them for the future. We are leaving out what we call critical dots, connecting the dots. Right. We're leaving out critical history. And that is probably part of the problem with Western and Americanized education, that it will not update itself according to what has happened in the culture, what's going on globally in the world, right? And watch this, because education is oftentimes propaganda that they're teaching to a particular trajectory. They're teaching toward a particular end, right? This is how I want this child to view a thing, not necessarily informing them of all of the context of that which happens and allowing them to develop comprehensive skills to be able to say, read a thing and place it appropriately in context in society. No, I'm going to say certain things. I'm going to call certain people heroes. I'm going to call certain people villains. I'm going to leave out segments of information and education that do not make me look well. And you normally find that in history and the social sciences, right? I'm not going to talk to them about, you know, different levels of language, not just westernized language, but I'm not going to talk about, you know, how we are, you know, Spanglish. We're not going to talk about that, which is a mixture of English and Spanish. I'm not going to talk about AAVE, African American Vernacular English, right? Because you got to, in the hour that we're living in, we have to give credibility and credence. Those are the words I wanted to use, to all of the languages, because they're all of the children that come to school, right? And we have to educate every child, right? Right? Not just the white child, but the black child and the Hispanic child and the Asian child. Our educational system should not just reflect one cultural hegemonic feature. It should be able or reflect what in fact is a multiplicity of cultures converging in this classroom, right? Now, you know what that will cause? That will cause us to perhaps go to and have conversations, watch this, with educational departments on the college level. Let me say this again. Now that we understand that if the measure of what we are doing in education is to educate every child and to have that education reflect an understanding of cultural relevance, then we're going to have to go back to colleges and have colloquies and colloquial, where we come and call assemblies and meetings and intensives to talk to administrations and administrators and deans of the College of Arts and Sciences, or the dean of the College of Education. Or you see what I'm saying? To be able to train teachers differently. Because if they're coming out of college with degrees in education, that education is only amounted to how they are effective teaching their entire populace. And that degree cannot be a certificate of propaganda. It has to be a certificate that causes them to understand that different children learn differently because of cultural or ethnic variances, that there are things that they are exposed to in the world that may not be yet documented by Houghton Mifflin, those who do the books, and they may not even be addressed, right? Because now they're entering into traditional spaces, hip hop language and, laxed language, where they come and they can, and they find that language in dictionaries, and yet they're not talked about in school, right? And maybe we need to talk to test takers or test creators, not test takers, but test creators, to make the test culturally relevant. Again, that is only when we are not viewing through the lens of a propagandized educational system, right? And we are making, in fact, all of the children the centerpiece and the center point of educational practices and protocols. That I know that's a lot of ways to say, a long way to say, that we need to think about how we are educating our children and what is the unique design for the programming and the curricula that we will set up that will cause them that when they graduate, they can deal with, watch this, not as the world in which it was, but the world that is, the world that will become, right? That each, we equip them properly to navigate certain careers, or navigate the nuances of a changing job market, a changing cultural sphere, right? That they can be viable, watch this word, citizens, right? That they will begin to understand how to take the society and the culture in which we place in their hands when they're 18, 19, 20, 21, and when they, graduate and begin to produce, become productive in society, that they will actually move us forward instead of trying to do something backwards from the 2000s, from the 90s, from the 80s. And simply because we like it and we're familiar with it, that just does not work in the modern world. You know, when I was educated in the school system, and you probably, most of you who are listening to me now, there was no AI. There was no artificial intelligence. There was no chat GPT, right? There were no programmings where you could just simply type in a question and this computer gives you information from all around the world, from different times. They pull from various catalogs, right? Man, if we had that back then, and here's the funny part, and I get it, because again, I'm in a PhD program, and so I get it. I get it that the whole notion is we want you to be able to read and we want you to be able to research. We want you to be able to do all of that. And I get it. That makes sense because being a PhD means that you're an expert in a particular area. That's academically what that means.
Right.
Right. That you know, you got the book sense and the book knowledge and all of that kind of stuff that goes with the area that you are studying. Right. But the reality is that our children in fifth grade can research and pull up in a PhD researched information. I mean, and so we couldn't do that. You know, we had to read a plethora of articles, a plethora of encyclopedias, you know. And let me say this. And the reason why I bring this up, because if we're dealing with traditional teachers and teachers that don't know how, watch this, to do both and instead of either or. To utilize the technology, to get them to embrace it, but also cause them to facilitate the usage of their mind, of their reading skills, of their math skills, and all of these other kinds of skills that we come with and that we are cultivated with learning, then again, they're going to teach that child in the classroom and shape them to be, you know, I'm doing this old school. Okay, I get it. I understand it. It's smart to do it old school, but you got to make room for new school. Let me try it again. Right? That, yes, teach them how to do it by hand. 2 + 2, no calculators. 25 times 5, no calculators. No calculators. I want you to show your work, right? But don't tell them don't use the calculator. Show them how to use a calculator. Show them how to use, you know, AI to their advantage. To gain knowledge and to move at a more effective and efficient rate. They're doing it in other countries is what I'm trying to say to you. They're doing it in other counties, Tuscaloosa. Hello. That there is an integration with the modern technology. Yes, the modern technology is embracing hands or holding hands with traditional educational policies, procedures, and technology. So we've got to learn how then what? To innovate. We've got to learn how to not demonize the future, but see it coming. We have to have teachers and administrators who know how to envision, right? One of the people that I'm having coming on this week is from Elevate Tuscaloosa. He's going to come in and talk about an innovative education program that's right here in Tuscaloosa that's coming, and I can't wait for that. That's going to be, you know, on Thursday they're going to be coming in. And I'm super excited about that because I think that if we don't find real ways, let me say it again, if we don't find real ways to teach and educate our children, we are going to miss an opportunity. There is the word, y'all. We have to prepare our children for an opportunity, but we have to take the opportunity to prepare for opportunity. We have to prepare our children, pre-plan our children for the coming opportunities in the world, right? And that is not taking away information, right? I believe in age-based information. Now, there's some information that just from it's the nature and the gravity of the subject matter that should not be taught in schools, right? Until a certain age, until a certain a mental and emotional matriculation that they've gone through, right? Until proper permission from parents, you know, things like sex education, drug education, you know, things of that nature. Those things, I don't think that that educational systems, and this is just me, you ain't got to agree with me, I don't think educational systems should just teach it because it's information at any age, in any stage. I don't think that, no, because that becomes indoctrination, especially if you don't have parents. Approval. When we learned about sex education or any kind of controversial topic, and I'm talking about in the 80s, right? In the early 80s, we had to have a parent permission form. We had to take that permission form, and our parents had to sign it that, yes, you can teach my child about sex education. Yes, you can discuss drugs with my child. Yes, you can bring in the classroom drug paraphernalia and all these other kinds of things so that my child can be educated. Some parents said no. And they developed another classroom while this specialized information was given. But most parents said yes, right? That, you know, that's the thing. But now you can't just say, First Amendment, you know, teach them everything. No, because there is a growth and maturation development that we've got to look at and regard, right? And so that's part and parcel how you bring even parents into the innovation, right? That you allow parents to say, okay, yes, my child is ready. Because when they come home, guess what? The parents going to have to talk about that. The parent, because they're going to ask questions. They're going to say, mommy, here's what we learned. Daddy, here's what we learned, right? And so we've just got to understand that that's a part of connecting the past with the future innovation, right? That's very, very, very important. Now, I'm also talking about an innovation, about the innovation about more men in classrooms, because that's a modern innovation. Now, I'm not saying that there are not men, especially black males in classrooms. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying that there has to be innovative programs that create opportunities and spaces for men to be a part of the educational process. Right. That's just a fact. Right. And, you know, that education and being a teacher is not a woman's position. It is not. Right? It's not simply and solely a woman's position. Right. But we've got to create incentives or incentivize the teaching position. Let me say it again. Incentivize the teaching position. Bishop, what you talking about? Pay the teachers more money. Right? Right? Because the man, if he decides to be a teacher, has to be able to take care of a family. The woman, if she decides to teach, has to be able to take care of a family. Right? You have to. My parents were teachers. My grandparents were teachers. And they were able to build a life for, you know, and they had children. And they sent us all to college. They sent us everywhere we wanted to go. They didn't have money for a bunch of the frivolities that we give our children today, which is an entirely different conversation. But as a teacher, which was a highly honorable profession in America at one time, has diminished so. It has diminished so. And that is because of our quasi-embrace of anti-intellectualism. That's a whole nother broadcast right there. That, in other words, there's a sector of America that enjoys being ignorant. They enjoy and delight in stupidity. They don't want information, don't want knowledge, don't want wisdom. They want to go by their instincts and their gut feelings, right? But that's a problem, because that instinct and knowledge and wisdom and the ability to gain wisdom and knowledge and information is one of the things that distance us from animals. Animals solely rely on instinct, right? Right? But humans, who are the apex of creation, knows how to gain information, knows how to extrapolate information, knows how to weigh information, truth from a lie, light from darkness, right? We know how to understand different sciences, how things are made, how things are, you know, we create theories. Animals don't do that. But here it is, culture call, here's the truth. There is a portion of the country that only wants us to live off of instincts. That is sending us back. I'm talking about light years back. We can't go back there. So we've got to think about how we're going to innovate and promote education and be able to make the teacher a highly valued profession, an innovative profession. A teacher right up there with an engineer, right up there with a doctor, huh? Right up there with a lawyer. Because you know what? It was a teacher that taught the doctor. It was a teacher that taught the lawyer. It was a teacher that taught the engineer. It was a teacher that taught the computer technician. And if we get away from understanding the importance of teachers, students, education, innovation, we're going to be late last loss, not just in Alabama or the United States, but in the entire world. So, hey, Culture Call, we're going to be talking about innovative educational strategies this week, and I need you to lean in. Hey, go ahead and get you some coffee and tea, some water, get you some toast. I think, yeah, we still a little bit on the breakfast side, and keep it locked right here on the Culture Call with yours truly, L. Spencer Smith.
This is the world.
And We are back right here on the Culture Call with yours truly, L. Spencer Smith. Praise 93.3 FM, 790 WTSK. And we are talking about innovative educational strategies. We are talking about that for this week. And I am super excited because, as a former educator, it's been years since I've been in the classroom and teaching. But I still have a passion. I think it's DNA because all of my family were that. I still have a passion for education. I still have a passion for teaching. And you know what? I'm getting my PhD degree now so I can go back to teach on an upper level, though. I can't go back to middle school. I started out in middle school. Yeah, I interned in high school, started out in middle school. Yeah, taught a college class, you know. And so, you know, I love college because, again, the way that, you know, I'm wired, is that just works best for me. That's the environment. But, hey, I just gave you information that you didn't even ask me. But nonetheless, yes, we have to talk about innovative education strategies for our local school systems, for our children and our home, because education begins at home. Our education begins at home. You know, when I'm teaching, when I'm preaching, when I'm instructing parents, I tell them that, you know, the kind of child that a teacher educates comes from your house. In other words, you have to prepare your child to learn. Yeah, let me say it again. You have to prepare your child to learn. And that means that while that child is in the non-lingual stage, the Google Gaga, the Baba, trying to formulate words that level, right? You have to begin to foster a sense of education. You know, Sesame Street, the games you buy, the numbers games, the puzzle games. You have to place a premium on that child learning, right? You just can't put them in front of a television and turn on something, a cartoon that has no educational viability, no educational, impartation to them just to keep them busy while you clean up the house or whatever you do. You've got to make sure that from the time they come out of the womb, that you speak to them in intelligible words, right? You speak, because guess what? The language and the way that they use language, they learn from you first, parents. Did y'all hear me, parents? Yes. They learn from you first. So if you splitting verbs, if you're not conjugating verbs right, if you're not using proper subject-verb agreement, you're not doing healthy practices, you're not taking time to be informed on the world, guess what? That's the kind of child or the environment you're creating for the child to appreciate learning or to disdain learning, right? If you don't celebrate, you know, if you don't do 1 + 1 is 2, 2 + 2 is 4, 3 + 3 is 6. If you're not doing that in your home, if you're not, you know, I'm talking about when they're little children, when they're still, but listen, if they can say no at the moment they say no, they need to be learning. And that's around 1.5, 2. When they can distinguish when they are ready to eat, when you potty train them, right there, you can train them to be educated or to be a learner, a lifetime learner, right from your house, right? Don't wait for Head Start or pre-K to do that. Let me say it again. Don't wait for Head Start or pre-K to do that. Other societies, other cultures, other ethnicities do not wait. As soon as that child comes and starts participating in the community of that family or that home, they start the educational process, right? And so we have to do that as well. You know, we've got to do that. I know Miss Little Shatira is beautiful and Little John John is just your pumpkin pie. But don't send them to school ignorant of any kind of learning principle and or context. Parents, and that is whether you are single parent, that is whether you are married, and that is whether you are grandparent and they stay with you while their parents at work. There has to be a system. There's got to be, again, an innovation, a strategy so that you can begin to place in that child a sincere cultivation for learning, a sincere attitude that says, I am excited to learn something new. There has to be celebration around learning. Yes, and instruction. The text, the Bible, is full of a text that says that we as parents ought to instruct our children. Do not rely on teachers, especially today's teachers, to simply be responsible for the education of your children. Right? They have certain restrictions now placed on them where they cannot. You know? Because everybody's concerned about what their child is learning. No, that's not the problem. The child is learning something anew and afresh because they're not hearing it about it in your house. They're not hearing about it from the parents. You see what I'm saying? So we have to, as parents, do the work. Let me say it again. Parents, we've got to do the work of, yes, reading books before bedtime, doing numbers, huh? Learning the alphabet so that when they get to these Head Start programs, they get to kindergarten, pre-K, or whatever they have signed up, right? Whatever they have formatted for, you know, I think they can go depending on need base or whatever. Children can go to school as early as 4 years old. But whatever it is, in those formative years, right? In those, and better yet, even those pre-formative years, educate. Give them an appreciation for learning something new. Give them an appreciation for learning and apprehending and comprehending what? New information, knowledge, right? You can't teach a child wisdom until knowledge is procured. If the child has no knowledge of a particular subject, teaching them wisdom in that particular subject may not work, right? Because you're going to have to teach knowledge, the basic principles of that area that you're trying to give them wisdom about. Because you're going to be, why are you telling me this? What is that? No, you see what I'm saying? So it all works fundamentally by foundational strategies and building blocks to get our children where we need to go. Right? And so now, watch this. Then you send your child into a classroom and you have a conference with that teacher, because all teachers do that at the beginning of the year, especially when they have open house, you know, they have conferences to figure out where your child is, all this different. They do that at the top of the year. Then you can go and talk to that teacher and say, okay, here's what we've worked on. Here's what they come knowing. Here's what we've doing, and boom, boom, boom. And okay. And so, I mean, at home, we go over this. I don't need them coming to class and being slowed down. That will alert that teacher, number one, that you're an active parent in the educational process. That parents are the prime innovation. I hope y'all just saw what I said. I said parents are the prime innovation. Because when you come in that classroom and you tell that teacher, listen, I was doing this, multiplication tables. Now, that ain't got nothing to do with me about the other parents, kids who don't know multiplication. But in our house, in the Smith household, yes, they are coming to kindergarten learning how, already knowing how to multiply, doing simple multiplication. They know that multiplication is made from the building blocks of addition. They know this. So what I don't want is me to send my child to you and you slow my child's learning process down. Hello. Because you've not done the innovation called parenting in your home. Every teacher that is worth their salt will tell you that the greatest innovation to child success in the learning process in the classroom is, watch this, the energy and the intentionality of their parents in that learning and educational process. That these kids came from homes where they already were doing this. Now, what does that do? That puts that teacher on alert, number one, that parent's going to be checking. I'm going to be checking to see what you teach. I'm going to be checking to see what they learn. I'm going to be, because we're going to talk about it. That also tells that teacher, watch this, that I better think of something a little extra to do, because that child, because here it is, especially if that school does not have a gifted program. And I don't know what level or what age we got tested early. You know, I think I got tested for gifted when I was in elementary school, right? And so I know some people, some places are waiting till middle school. Too late. No, right. That is too late. But, you know, hey, whatever it is. But that would alert that teacher that maybe I need to assemble a group of students and get permission to see if I can keep them or I can instruct them, or give them a different curriculum or something, or if we can have advanced classes. Remember what I told you. I told you that when I was growing up, they had certain levels and degrees of learning context, right? That the students who were a little slower, a little, you know, had certain special learning, needs, they put in one class, all of them in one class. Then the regular average students, you know, that were just, you know, coming in, but they could comprehend well and they moved at the regular pace, they put them in another class. And then the students that came with advanced knowledge and, you know, some sort of a rapid motion toward learning concepts and context and other ideas, they put us in another class. Well, see, now there's a whole idea of mainstreaming, right? And what that means is we want to put all in one class because we don't want children to feel different. I get what you're trying to do, but I don't necessarily know if that works because the psychological notion is that the sociology between the special student, the regular student, and the advanced student, the sociology between them, the societal context, will cause each of them to learn at a rapid pace, right? That, you know, no child left behind. I get that. But the truth of the matter is that is yet to be proven, right? Because if a child is coming to school already knowing their multiplication tables, and you put them in the same classroom with a child that has a learning, a different level, a different way of learning. Maybe they're dyslexic or they have, you know, other kind of learning disabilities. You put them in the same classroom in advance. It's either going to slow that child, that advanced child down, which you do not want to do. Because you're going to have to be paying attention so much, that teacher is going to have to be paying attention so much to that special needs child, that one that is in need of special educational, you know, tactics and techniques, that has an IEP in the office, right? So you're going to slow it down. Instead of expanding the curricular and the programming at our school to facilitate that, each of those levels that I just told you, so that everybody can move at their own pace unthreatened. Because what they're thinking as adults, right? I sat in rooms where we had these discussions, y'all. They're thinking as adults, right? And they don't want their little Billy or their little Mary to feel bad about the level or the context that they learn on. But the reality is, watch this, the reality is they still, at that age, when you're in elementary school, a part of it is you know, the janking, a part of the of the socialization context is to make fun, is to, you know, I always tell them there is a quasi bullying context to all levels as they learn how to socialize. Now, this is why we got to teach citizenship. This is why we got to teach at our homes. There it is again, how to treat people and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, a part of the socialization context is the crack jokes. Not that they're trying to be harmful. That's just a part of the growth context. But Bishop, that ain't right. I get it ain't right. But we're not talking about right or wrong. And the reason why it ain't right, because right now you 35, you 40, you should be out of that, right? But as a child, they're still learning the world. They're still learning relationships. They're still learning friendships. And that is integrated and infused within the learning capability context, right? So that is important, culture call. I don't know why people don't understand that, right? But because of cutbacks, because of shaving off programmings, because of XYZ, and we want to, you know, and teachers should not have to be paid more money at the risk of, or at the expense, rather, not risk, but at the expense of innovative programming for students. That you mean I got to pay Miss McCaskill more money in order for me to do that? I got to take away something that's benefiting our kids? I got to take advanced level learning? I got to take that away? You know? And so, yeah, that's something that we need to recognize. I remember that I was teaching in Jacksonville, Florida, at Kirby Smith Middle School. And they built there. There was a school in the urban area. But they rebuilt the school to feature a replica of inside the Challenger space system, a space shuttle, that blew up in Florida, right? And so when you walked in that part of the building, it was like NASA. It was like straight NASA. And they called it a Montessori school. And teachers from Tuscaloosa came there because University Place Elementary was, I don't know if it's still a Montessori school, but they were trying to become a Montessori school here in Tuscaloosa, right? And Montessori at that time was an innovative educational strategy, innovative educational principle, right? And so, and it was very advanced. It was very advanced. These kids were specializing in science and they were integrating a whole lot. It was a whole kind of free learning model. Wasn't as restrictive as traditional learning, right? Which I thought was really well. The problem that I had was there was not enough African-American representation in that area. And so, you know, of course, I voiced my opinion until they started adding more kids that looked like me into that program. Into why they can't go in to learn about NASA. Why can't they go in to learn about the shuttle? But here it is. I also had to do teaching on behavior and discipline because that was one of the factors that they were using to keep our children out. Not that they were misbehaving, but it was kind of a prejudging, a prejudice that they had because, of course, the school was in the inner cities of Jacksonville, Florida. But we got those kids in that program and they began to advance. I'm talking about light years. Because if you give a child an opportunity to learn, and you put inside of them a hunger for learning and education, then when you begin to bring innovative strategies, they'll eat it for lunch. They will talk to you and help you re-envision and rewrite your program by what they see coming, right? Things that we as adults can't see. But you've got to give people an opportunity. And so one of the things we've got to do is understand, number one, from the floor to the ceiling, that the first level of educational innovation is proper parenting, making sure that the parents from the pre-learning stages, right, all the way up to when they hit kindergarten, you are involved in that child's learning process. Yep, don't just sit them in front of the TV. Don't give them a PlayStation or all these other kind of things that they have, Nintendo. Don't give them that. You sit down, read a book. Or you give them information that shows on videos or whatever it is that teach them a particular educational concept. ABCs, 1, 2, 3s, you know what to do. Yeah. So that our children can have a head start without having gone to Head Start, right? Listen, this is your boy, L. Spencer Smith, right here on the Culture Call. Praise 93.3, 790 WTSK. Got to take a break, but I need you to keep it locked right here.
This is the world.
We are back. It's the top of the hour, 11 a.m. and some change right here on the Culture Call with your boy, Elizabeth Smith. Want to welcome all of our second hour listeners. Yeah, maybe you were in a meeting or, just getting up. Y'all don't know. But I'm glad that you leaned in and tuned in to the Culture Call right here on Praise 93.3, 790 WTSK. And we have been having an amazing day talking about innovative education strategies. And that's what our focus is on this week. And we're going to sprinkle in an honor for International Women's History even this month because we can't do it without the ladies. We cannot do it without our sisters. Absolutely. And so we're going to sprinkle that in a little bit later in the show. But we want to go back and just capture some things and talk about the necessity for innovation in education, especially we're coming off of the failed vote for increased resources for the city schools and their need. Some say, well, they got enough money. And others say, well, we don't have enough money. And so there seems to be some kind of back and forth going on with that notion. But at the end of the day, what is important, our greatest resource are the children, right? Our greatest resources are the children. And I think it's very important for us to, you know, do whatever we can as those who have already matriculated through school systems to provide the best. Let me say that word again. Provide the best culture call, the best educational situations and advantages for our children so that they can be a part of creating the future, that they're not just reacting to what has been created for the future, but they can be the creators of the future. And that can only happen but when we create a thirst, a hunger, and also a proper placement and strategies, vehicles for educational excellence and assessments and, you know, advancements. That's just important. We got to, in some cases, bite the bullet. We're living in an inflationary world, a world that is perhaps even on the brink of recession. And, you know, things are expensive. And I get it. I understand. I promise you I do. However, I need us to understand that those of us have to be responsible for providing, just as those before us were responsible for providing for us. And so we have to rethink this education. And the first thing I wanted to start off with is, you know, the greatest educational innovation is parents. That's right. That's the greatest educational innovation is parents, right? That's who they are the parents. They are the primary foundational factor of how a child can or not can, but will and will not learn, right? That we take that can learn, and as parents, we form it and transform it into will learn. Did that make sense? Yes. Right? So we take that newborn baby, and from the time that they come home from the hospital and they get into our environment, our family structure, right? They get acclimated with our home. We take their can learn, yes, with and transform it into will learn, a thirst for learning. So the second level of innovation is the child itself, the student itself. That's an innovation. What do you mean? How is the student an innovative educational strategy? Oh, no problem. Because, again, that parent is sending their product to the school. And that school now, watch this, every school rating is contingent upon student performance. Now, we can say teacher performance, but teacher performance is only rated by the success of his or her students. So, you know, we have to send a child that is not just able to learn, but watch this, available to learn. Right? That they're in this place, that we show them that they're responsible. Part of their responsibility is to educate themselves, because they won't stay 5 and 6 forever. They're going to become 15 and 16. Huh? Then they're going to be, you know, 25, 26. You know, we look at adults today and we're like, what in the world? What happened? Something wrong? Did something happen to milk? Was the Similac bad? You know, Enfamil didn't get enough. We start looking at adults. Watch this. But though, if you trace it, I promise you, Culture Call, if you trace it back, you will find out that there were already deficiencies in effectiveness happening when they were sent to school. So not only is it parents. The parent is an innovation, but also the student, the child, is an innovation. And the question that we have to ask in our educational system, as we begin to innovate and draft strategy, is, are we doing enough to make sure that this child is not impeded in their learning process, that we are supporting and providing the technology, the techniques? We are providing them with everything that they need to learn beyond basic reading, writing, and arithmetic. But are we also providing a learning environment for their specialties, for their particular intelligence, their particular bent, their particular level of interest? Or are we putting them in a traditional, westernized, cookie cutter system that makes no room for the advance or for their own cultivation within them to be able to learn in the direction that they need to learn. And we already have a school here in Tuscaloosa that does it, right? Our children, my twins, they went to the Capital School. Now, I haven't been to this Capital School. My kids are in their 30s now. But when I tell you the Capital School and their teacher at the time was Miss Genevieve Snipes. Genevieve Snipes was the man. Listen, that little lady told my wife and I, just leave them here, and I'm going to assess them, and y'all don't come around, don't come back until, give me about 30, 40 minutes. And so that was when we first enrolled them. And she came back, and she said, okay, Mr. Smith, Ms. Smith, here in just talking with your children, here is what I learned. I mean, and she read them when they were about 4, 5, 6. I don't want to say it in religious language, but I will say it. She prophesied accurately exactly how our children would be in the future of their learning capability in school. I'm talking about all the way up to college. She hit it right on the head. Right? And that happened right there at the Capital School. Right? And it was like, yo, that she told us how my daughter would learn. She told us how the environment that my son would learn. She told us what kind of students they would be. All of that. She gave us and then watch this. Then she began to teach them according to the way she figured out that was best for them to learn. Now, the Capital School is a private school. It is a private school. A friend at the church recommended, because she sent her children there, and she recommended our children go there. So we took a recommendation. They got an interview, blah, blah, blah. We, you know, part of it, we pay for them to go, whatever. That was the first time I learned about a multiple intelligence school. Now, here's what I am saying, Coach Call, that every school may not be able to fund multiple intelligence pedagogy. They may not be able to fund, you know, the way that each child learns, right? I get that. But what each teacher has to do, is take some time to at least do what Genevieve Snipes did at that time. As that is, I hear what you're saying, parents, but let me meet your students. Teachers have a certain time before they can, I've been out of the school system. I don't know if it's legal or not, but, you know, this got so many illegalities now. But nonetheless, set up a time where if you got these amount of kids in your class, set up a time where you call the parent and say, hey, I would love to schedule a meeting with your child before they start school. And you meet with the children, and you meet with their parents, and you meet with that child, maybe 10, 15 minutes, and that teacher begins to assess. That's why I said we're going to have to go back. If we're going to have education innovative strategies, we got to go back to colleges and universities and tell them, here's something that you need to add to your curriculum before you allow these teachers of today to graduate with a degree from your university and your particular college in hand. Then they need to have some level of understanding in innovative educational strategies with regards to Montessori, multiple intelligence, cultural relevance, you know, curriculum, you know, all of these things. They need to have some kind of education, some kind of knowledge base, yes, some kind of research and all of that. Don't send them out here cold turkey just teaching them, you know, Piaget, teaching them all of the traditional Maslowian, all those different kinds of things that they learned in educational psychology. They need to understand what's going on in today's educational system, what's going on with today's children, what they will have to face, so that we can find out how to maximize our children's capabilities in the classroom. Teach the lesson. I am. Now, to some of you, this might be boring. It might be, oh, goodness. Can he talk about politics? Okay, no, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about it. That is what it is. The issue is, to me, what are we going to do? You know, what is we going to do in the meantime? You feel what I'm saying? That our children have to be properly educated. We have to align them, and we have to make sure that they are capable of producing in an advanced world. They have to do that. That's what teachers are designed to do, to prepare us, you know? In our cultural context, our teachers told us, hey, you got to do twice as good to even get an opportunity. You got to do their B is equivalent to your A plus at that. And sometimes your C, their C is equivalent. They're going to view it as equivalent to your A. So you got to make A's. And so we strived hard to do what our teachers prepared us to do. And they did not take it easy on us. They pulled out the maximum. And they said, okay, I need you to do this. I need you to learn it. And here it is. Teachers, parents, please listen to this. Teachers have to have the prerogative to put a little bit of pressure on your children. It cannot always be easy. Ease does not teach. It is challenge that teaches. So don't always go there. Well, why they give you something that hard? If you can't do it, that's okay. That's on you. Okay. But tell your child, okay, well, study then. Are you listening in class? Pay attention in class. Because we want you to be successful. I want you to do it the best of your ability. Right? If you can learn that PlayStation, that Nintendo, at age 5, if you can learn the computer, the iPad, the iPhone, you can do all these advanced, then what this teacher teaching you in class, you ought to be able to do. See how that works? Right? Challenge them and push them forward into that innovative capacity, into that capacity where they are doing their best. That student has to understand when they come from your house that the best is required from them. In the classroom, that teacher has to have that understanding that I require the best of all of my students. And not only do I require them to have the best, but I'm going to give them the best. Yes. And so I'm going to make up the difference. Let me say this again. I'm going to make up the difference for what they don't teach in the textbooks, because teachers normally in the classroom don't write the textbooks. Normally the people that write the textbooks haven't been in classrooms in years, if they've ever been in classrooms. You know? And so the curriculum in the book or the book can be so distant and disconnected from what's happening in the real world of education and in the classroom. But that teacher has to bring in materials to say, okay, well, you know, this is not what it says in your book, or your book doesn't teach this, but I'm going to bring in this. Now, parents, here we go again. Parents, Alabama Southern parents, you can't come up. I don't want my child to learn about the Constitution. I don't want my child to learn. Oh, goodness. In other words, what you're saying is I want my child to stay in the dark just like me. That's what you're trying to say. That's what you're trying to say, Coach Carl. I don't want them to learn that. You don't want them to learn what you don't know because you're afraid that they'll ask you a question that may embarrass you and your lack of knowledge in a particular area. Don't do that. Give your children all of their wings. Give it to them. And let them come on when you say, hey, what you learned in school today? Well, I learned the Pythagorean theorem. The who, the what? Did you just use profanity? No, the Pythagorean theorem. I learned that in pre-algebra. I learned that in geometry. And they begin to educate you about what it is. Because education, come closer, is a communal asset, a communal responsibility. We live and we learn together. We educate. We learn together. We teach. Huh? And we learn together as community. Right? That's important. You know, ooh, daddy, I bet you don't know X, Y, Z. you know, and be like, yeah, you sure right. They didn't teach me that. Daddy, you know how to work AI, mama, you know how to work ChatGPT. You know that's a new innovation that XYZ, but it, you know, you know the new math? No, you don't know. I can teach you the new math. You want me to teach you the new math? But yeah, show me a problem. You see, that learning has to be communal. You're never too old to learn. You didn't think you could learn Facebook, but you did. You got it on your phone. You didn't think you could learn some of these innovations. And here it is. Here it is. That's why they are shutting down jobs and things that you know so well, been there so long, and there's been no real innovation, right? And so in a minute, you know, I can't speak for the current administration, but in a minute, those who are dealing with fossil fuel cars are going to have to learn the innovation of electric cars and how to make them if they want to have jobs. Not to say that fossil fuels will ever go out, but those factories will not be as big because look at the market demand. Let me say it again. Look at the market demand. I went walking yesterday and they had electric pumps. That's what I call them. They had electric chargers, like five of them at the park where my wife and I went to walk. And they had them where they could plug in their cars for electrical refueling. You see what I'm saying? They're already making room. So instead of fighting the future, instead of fighting the coming innovation, start preparing now. And how do you prepare? Listen to your children. Teachers got to be equipped with this understanding. So we got the parents as an innovator and an innovation. We've got the student as an innovation. And next, yes, we have this teacher as the innovators, as an innovation. We got to have that. That again, I'm not on any school board. I'm not on any school, ad hoc or anything, task force. I'm not on any of that. But if I was, I'd be having conversations with first of all, the college professors and instructors. I would invite them to the table. I would invite education students from UA Stillman and Shelton State. I'd invite them to this colloquy, this symposium. I would have, who do I want there too? I would have present teachers and administrators. And we would talk about how the education is changing in our society. We would talk about the necessities of the future. And you know what? Conversations, and I'm talking about really, conversations need to be had more like that in the South. Not to say that they're not, because I know that there are, because I have a few people I'm connected to that go to innovations, but they need to be happening at a rapid pace and a more increased pace during the summers and all that. They need to be, you know, those in-services need to be technological in-services to where we begin to educate and empower teachers to utilize innovative technological skills to in the classroom that we need to place in colleges, the charge on these professors and these traditional systems to say, hey, you gotta update, you gotta upgrade. And again, a lot of them are. See, but we definitely have to make the teacher an innovative force in the classroom, that we take restrictions off of their hands, right? That we do place boundaries, but not restrictions. Boundaries, okay, this needs to be taught at this age. We need to scale it properly, right? So that we won't be offensive to the parents and teaching their children something that they are not ready for their children to learn. You feel what I'm saying? And so we need to scale it properly for that. And then we need to let those teachers do what they have been degreed to do and got master's degrees to do, and that's teach. We need to, right? And let them teach that they're supposed to teach. And hold them accountable for teaching. right? And not just teaching for the test. You're teaching for, watch this, societal and global innovation. Not just teaching so they can pass the test so a school system can look good. Right? No. But you're letting those teachers teach to innovate the students, bring them, prepare them for the future, right? And to make sure that our students are being equipped to operate in the global economy, in the global community, right? It is a well-known fact that whenever a marriage happens, a family is about to be created, a serious family, and they're about to move in a location, the first thing they're going to ask is about what? The school system. Where is the best school system? Who has the best programs? Who has the best teachers? Who has the best safety? Huh? Yeah, that's what they're asking. See, and I don't blame them, because you know, and of course there are, again, I don't want to talk about politics, but there's some political, economical, social political things. That's the safest word to use. Things that we need to address there. But every person wants their child to be in a neighborhood, with a good school. Because that school is supposed to teach that child to be effective and successful in a global economy. That's what it's supposed to do. But we got to bring all to the table. You see, we did building blocks. Parents first, then they prepare that child, then the student going to school, and now the teacher. And in the next part, I'm going to land probably on this today, because I'm bringing in an administrator. I won't get to administration till maybe about Thursday, right? Maybe about Thursday. I'm going to get to administrator because I want to talk to an administrator about educational innovation and how they're dealing with the politics of learning how to appropriate specific funds in the area of institutional and educational advancement. But I need y'all to keep it right here on your show, The Culture Call, with your boy L. Spencer Smith, right here, Praise 93.3, 790 WTSK. This is the world premiere. And we are back right here on The Culture Call with yours truly, L. Spencer Smith. I am telling you, we've been having a great day here at 790 WTSK and Praise 93.3 FM. Hey, I'm telling you, we've been talking about educational innovative strategy. Innovative educational strategy. Yeah, I like that one a little bit better. It flows. Nonetheless, we've been talking about that in such a way that I wanted to stir your interest, especially as we come to the end of school and as this is hitting the ground running, right? Seniors about to, you know, they're going to their next portion. We're asking juniors, you know, where they want to go, preparing for their future. That education is one of those ever-flowing systems in our culture, in our society, that, you know, that we have to position our minds for and to properly plan for, so that we can, again, make our children today adults that are viable in the global community, in the global economy, et cetera, right? But I want to take time on this International Women's Month. I want to take time to frame it properly, right? To tie it all in. And today, I want to acknowledge, applaud, and laud an innovative woman that graced our society, our country, and that is Representative Shirley Chisholm, right? She was born on November 30th, 1924 in Brooklyn, New York. That's right. And she was an immigrant from Barbados in Guyana. She spent her early childhood in Barbados with her grandparents, where she developed a strong sense of self-reliance and social justice. Chisholm returned to the United States at the age of 10 and settled in Brooklyn with her parents. She attended Brooklyn College, where she earned a bachelor's degree in sociology in 1946. Chisholm later earned a master's degree in early childhood education from Columbia University in 1952. Chisholm began her career as a teacher and later became a director of a child care center. Her entry into politics was motivated by her desire to address social and economic issues affecting her community. In 1974, she was elected to the New York State Assembly, where she served for 4 years. Then, in 1968, Chisholm made history by becoming the first African-American woman elected to Congress, representing New York's 12th congressional district. She served seven terms. Wow. Seven terms in the House of Representatives, championing progressive causes such as civil rights, women's rights, and health care reform. In 1972, Chisholm made a groundbreaking bid for the Democratic national presidential nomination, becoming the first African-American and the first woman to run for a major party's presidential nomination. Although she did not win the nomination, her campaign helped pave the way for future generations of women and minorities in politics. Chisholm's legacy extends beyond her political career. She was a prolific author, writing several books, including her autobiography, Unbought and Unbossed. She received numerous awards and honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2015, which was awarded posthumously. Chisholm married Conrad Chisholm in 1949, and the couple divorced in 1977. She later married Arthur Hardwick Jr. in 1977, and they remarried again. They remained together until his death in 1986. Chisholm passed away on January 1st, 2005, at the age of 80, leaving behind a legacy as a trailblazer, politician, educator, and advocate for social justice. Her life and her achievements continue to inspire new generations of leaders and change makers. Listen, we honor today all of the sisters, the women, listen, who are doing amazing things on this International Women's Month. But today we place a spotlight on the Honorable Shirley Chisholm, 1924-2025. Listen, she was an amazing educator. And that's why I wanted to bring her up, because she, along with other women of her age, we probably heard of Marva Collins. All of those innovators in terms of teaching our community and teaching our children. Also embracing, understanding that education was also a social justice issue. That the whole idea of Brown versus the Board of Education, separate but equal, all of those things, the integration of schools, all of those things they championed. Women were on the front line in championing. And I think that is so very important, because at that time, a lot of teachers did double duty. They taught early and they left their classrooms to be on the front lines, to be in the political sphere, to make sure that our children received the best education that they could at that time. And so yes, education is also a social justice issue. It is an innovation of a social justice outlay that will cause us to understand that there is no global and or community advancement without us focusing on the primacy of having education available, quality education available to every child. Every child, regardless of race, color, creed, gender, socioeconomic status, every child deserves to have a quality education. Now, when in this country, we make everything about dollars and cents, right? We make everything about how much something costs. Where are we putting our money? Where we will be accountable for our money, to our money, right? And proper accounting of our finances say that if we don't fuel and fund our education, for whatever reason, culture call, whatever reason, the bill, and I know it was about funding. You know, part of it was about funding. It's going to cost this person that much. It's going to cost this much, you know? But that's the way that the state has set up for us to procure funding for our education. It's a part of our ad valorem tax. It's a part of our property tax. That's just how it's set up. And we cannot allow schools to go down in one neighborhood but favor in the other neighborhoods. We cannot allow our children to have books that are, you know, not just culturally disconnected, but even historically disconnected. We cannot have teachers that are just simply waiting for the end of the day because they've been fighting more than they've been educating. They've been at task dealing with behavioral issues and problems that perhaps should have been taken care of in the home or had a different class. And I'm not talking about in school suspension. I'm talking about a class that is focused on addressing and you're meeting the needs of those who are special needs, who need a special, a slower pace than the normal child. Right? I think that's what we've got to do. We've got to call those things and begin to address those things as they are, as they were. We have to do that. Because if we do not, the future is swiftly becoming today. Because today is swiftly becoming yesterday. And the past is swiftly being put in the ground. And so we need to figure out, as a society, as a community, as intelligent people in this country, in this state, in our city, what is important to us, our children are. And we've got to find the resources, We've got to fit. We can find money for everything else. And I know the particularities of allocations and, you know, on budgets and all that. I know certain money's got to go to certain things. Infrastructure needs money. I know, you know, different things that needs, public safety needs money. I get it. I understand. But what kind of children are we producing that we are adding to the workforce? What kind? What are we doing there? And we've got to answer that question, right? Are our children behind, you know, in Tuscaloosa, are they behind Hoover? Huh? And are they behind the school systems in Montgomery? Are they behind the school systems in Huntsville? Yeah? Well, we have to start asking ourselves these questions. And are we satisfied? There it is. Are we satisfied with our children being behind? You see what I'm saying? And if we are not, because I know we are not, then parents, students, teachers, administrators, systems, superintendents, all of those people, politicians, have to make a concerted effort, an effort in concert together to do what we need to do to make sure that not one child in our community and our state is left behind, in our country. That we will not be a country that is late, last, and lost. We're slowly moving toward culture call. A whole society that hates education, that they just want to be able to lie and to speak whatever they consider to be the truth. No facts, no empirical evidence, no research, no supportive data. We don't want that. We don't want that because they have been so indoctrinated with someone else's advance means something wrong for them. They have been so indoctrinated to make you think that if this person learns, then there's something that I can't learn. We have been so indoctrinated with that piece of the puzzle, or better yet, with elevating and celebrating the missingness of that one piece, that we'll build a whole government around it. We'll put an uneducated person to be the, because they have money, we'll put a person who has no degree, no understanding of how education literally works, we'll put them over the DOE. For what? Come on, y'all. For what? Just abandon all what your prejudicial predilection. Abandon all of that. Why would you celebrate ignorance? Why would we celebrate a lack of intellectual advancement. Why would we celebrate children not being able to eat, children not being able to satisfy that Maslowian growth needs? That they eat, they've eaten, they're fed, they're clothed. Why would we take out books that shows a diversity of history? Why? Why would we take out Head Start? Why? That speaks highly of the kind of people that are in charge of our nation. And whether you voted for them or not, that speaks about you, that speaks about who we are as a people. We got to do better. And it begins with education. Listen, I am telling you, make it a plan and a ploy, a strategy to build your child to be a reservoir for knowledge and learning. That is the only way. Education is still the key to the future. I'll say it again. Education is still the key to the future. And I hope that each and every one of us will put the keys in our children's hand and help them turn so that they can be all they need to be for tomorrow's greatness in our country. Listen, this is your boy, L. Spencer Smith, right here on the Culture Call. We're about to land this plane, but I need you to keep it locked right here. Huh? Praise 93.3, 790 WTSK.
This is the world premiere.
Well, we've come to the end of another broadcast. Thank you all so, so very much for tuning in to the Culture Call, being a part of the CC family with your boy, L. Spencer Smith, right here on Praise 93.3, 790 WTSK. I'm telling you, we could not do it without you. And so even as we talk about innovation, educational innovation strategies this week, I want you to think about all that we said. Yeah, I want you to reflect on everything that we said and be ready to be a part, a viable part of leaning in to making sure that our community is strong and our children are ready for the future. You know, my grandmama and my mama used to say at the end of every phone call, I love you a bushel, I love you a peck, and I love you a hug around the neck. This has been Bishop L. Spencer Smith right here on the Culture Call, 790 WTSK, Praise 93.3 FM. I'm telling you, I need you to be nice. I'm telling you, that's right, I need you to be at peace. I need you to pray for somebody who you don't know. I need you to pray for those who you do know. Embrace them. Tell them that you love them. Tell them that you care. In the world that feels like empathy and having compassion on other people is something that's toxic and anathema, something that's accursed, you be different. You be the difference in somebody's life. Love them on purpose. I want you to do that. You all have a great and fantastic day, and we'll catch you tomorrow morning, hey, for another Culture Call.